Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. You were listening to the National Anthem of the Vatican, which was played twice yesterday after a new pope, Pope Francis I, was introduced to the world. 2 weeks ago, the Catholic Church and the world witnessed an unusual changing of the guard as Pope Benedict XVI stepped down from a seat promised to him for life. It was the first time in nearly 600 years that a pope has resigned. Yesterday, after 2 days of deliberation, the conclave elected Benedict's replacement, the former Cardinal Jorge Bergoglio of Argentina, a former Archbishop of Buenos Aires, who took the name of Francis I. Joining us by phone to talk about the election is Monsignor Eugene Morris. He is the Director of Sacred Liturgy at the Pontifical College Josephinum. Welcome to the show, Monsignor.
And thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Also by phone is Michael Winters. He's a columnist for the National Catholic Reporter. Welcome.
Good to be here.
And also joining us in the studio, Leo Madden. He heads the theology department at Ohio Dominican University here in Columbus. Professor Madden, welcome back.
Happy to be here. Thanks, Ben.
Monsignor, right off the bat, Pope Francis was not among the front runners identified before the election necessarily. Surprise?
Well, in one level, yes. You know, given what we know about the process, he apparently was a contender actually at the last election when Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI was elected. And even several days prior to going into the conclave, there were a number of articles in Rome itself that were mentioning his name as a possibility. So it is a surprise in one sense, but his name was kind of floating out there a little bit. So, but yes, I mean, as I was watching, I was surprised.
So at a time like this, what do people talk about at the Pontifical College Josephinum? I mean, how does this ripple through your organization and where you work?
Well, all the guys were excited. And of course, I mean, the nature of our seminary as a pontifical seminary, we're the only pontifical seminary outside of Rome, actually. And so there is a unique connection that we have with Rome and with the Holy Father, though, again, it's not as if he is intimately involved in the day-to-day runnings of the seminary or anything of that nature, but just by our pontifical status, drawn into connection with him. So there was an energy and an excitement around the fact that the conclave was complete, that we have a new pope. And you can feel even today just kind of almost a sense of relief. Now things kind of can get back to normal in a way, although obviously with the new pontiff there are going to be new initiatives and new directions, but there's a kind of a stability that we now kind of return to, knowing that our Holy Father is sitting on the throne of Peter and kind of going from there. So there was both a great sense of kind of joy at the completion of this, but also kind of a beautiful opportunity to return to normalcy.
Michael Winters, normalcy yet, or do you have a lot of analysis to go through as a journalist, someone who covers the Roman Catholic Church for National Catholic Reporter? What's next?
I think the most important thing, obviously, is that as a Latin American cardinal and archbishop in Buenos Aires, he has been part of the Latin Americans wrestling with a very singular question, which has been, you know, what does the preferential option for the poor mean? And obviously, liberation theology was found to be very inadequate in terms of its Christian anthropology. On the other hand, if you read some of the talks he's given and sermons, he's very hostile to what we would consider kind of conservative economics here in the States. And so I think, you know, we in America, our church is so affluent, and our country is so affluent. It's really hard for us to imagine what it's like to be a bishop who knows that, you know, 40 or 50 or 60% of his people are going to bed hungry at night, who live in these very poor shanty towns that you have outside all the major cities in Latin America. And so the Latin American bishops that I've come to know, when they say the preferential option for the poor, it's not just words on a page. It's not just words from the pulpit. This is their lived reality, and it goes beyond just trying to provide social services, although obviously it includes that. It's really a very refined critique of the social structures and economic systems that have created this, and not just systems that are out there, but the systems of the heart, the acquisitiveness that obviously a consumer society thrives on. So I'm anticipating that we will have much continuity. I think Benedict himself was also very critical of contemporary capitalism. But I think that may even be more heightened. And from what we can tell about this pope, he may be less of a teaching pope. There may be fewer documents. But I suspect we're going to see him at soup kitchens a little more often.
Monsignor, less of a teaching pope, more of an activist in that kind of a literal sense. How does something like this translate into the teachings at the Pontifical College Josephinum, given that it's the only one outside of Rome, and given the fact that it's in the heart of, you know, the center of the universe of capitalism?
Well, I mean, his actions obviously will become an example for how our men, when they become priests, then would exercise their priestly life. And I think, you know, as Michael was describing, that wrestling with that question and putting that into praxis, and again, moving beyond just simply, you know, taking care of social needs, or even for us in this country, oftentimes simply just the giving of money and not really kind of looking at that, you know, it will require from us, as we instruct them and then as they go forth, to kind of ask themselves that practical question: what's this going to look like in my priestly life? How is this actually going to play itself out? And what he's doing by way of example and whatever teaching he provides for us in the written form — he himself is an author, has written several articles and books and things of that nature — I would anticipate that as well. But in both of those dynamics, we'll provide an example for our men as to how they would live out their priestly lives.
Professor Madden, when a pope is less of a teacher and more of an activist, like in this way, does that change the course of the history of the church, you know, from where you sit as a scholar of it?
I anticipate, in large part, quite a lot of continuity. Certainly, the fundamental doctrines will not change. The creed will not change. The fundamental teachings, as most recently expressed in Second Vatican Council, will not change. A number of initiatives and priorities may develop. I'm thinking now, hearing what the two individuals prior to me spoke about, I'm thinking now of the beginning of G.K. Chesterton's book on Thomas Aquinas, The Dumb Ox, where the first chapter he imagines Thomas Aquinas and Francis of Assisi walking side by side. And Chesterton says that the church gets, at a certain point, the saints it deserves. And in this case, perhaps the church and the world gets a pontiff it deserves, someone who directs our attention to beauty, someone who directs our attention to the needs of the poor, to the needs of the forgotten, those who are ill or left behind, living alone in quiet desperation towards the end of their lives.
Besides the fact it'll be the first popes whose name I can remember very easily, Pope Francis I, yay, what goes into the idea of how the pope names himself? Does he do it while they're fitting the papal robes? I mean, when do you do that? When do you decide something like that, Monsignor?
That's a good question, and I honestly don't know. I speculate that in one sense, I mean, all of them walking in there, realizing that they theoretically could have been chosen, must have given at some point thought to what this might be. I suspect some of them probably thought, never happened to me. But what we know about our Holy Father Francis is that he spent a great deal of effort actually avoiding any type of curial positions in Rome, and really only came to Rome when he absolutely had to. So this is a man who really has avoided this. So the fact that he did have a name obviously chosen at some point, you know, he was obviously thinking about this. But as to when that moment actually would come, I don't know. I think it is certainly interesting and reflective of in some sense, what we can anticipate from our Holy Father, that he didn't choose Francis. And he specifically made it very clear this is Francis of Assisi. As a Jesuit himself, it could have been Francis Xavier or the third general of the society, Francis Borgia. But he chose Francis of Assisi, who, you know, when receiving the command from the Lord to build the church, did so by focusing on the needs of the people of God, not just in the physical buildings themselves, but actually the people themselves as well. So there's a great deal of significance in the choice that he's given us, the choice that he's made.
Francis Xavier, the Spanish missionary, founder of the Jesuits, the Order of the New Pope, Leo Madden, any thoughts about that process? Has anyone ever talked about it before?
Well, I understand from some reports, specifically Archbishop Dolan said that immediately, or very shortly after his election, he made it clear, that is to say, Pope Francis made it clear that his name is Pope Francis, to be named after Francis of Assisi.
Mm-hmm. The process, though, has it ever been written about? Has anyone ever talked about the process they go through?
That I don't know. The custom was not original to the office of the Bishop of Rome. It arose in the early Middle Ages when an individual by the name of Mercurius was named Bishop of Rome, and he did not want to have the name of a Roman god, Mercury, so he changed his name to John the First.
Michael Winters, the reach the Catholic Church southward has grown over the last century. There's more than 200 million more Catholics in Latin America than in Europe. Was this inevitable?
I think it was inevitable. I mean, but that didn't mean it had to happen this round. And I also think we tend to overplay the national significance, the questions of age, and I confess to being guilty of that. He was not on my short list because I thought at 76 he would be too old. But I do
he
think
he looks like a young 76.
He does.
Though.
He does. And I think, but what really matters to the Cardinals as every vote goes by is a very personal question, which is just, can they see him in those white robes? Can they imagine going up and vowing obedience to them? To him? Can they imagine him presiding at prayer over the Universal Church? Now, there have been prior conversations about, you know, what are his issues, and that not just in this period of since Benedict's resignation, but, you know, what did he say 4 years or 5 years ago? Did he commiserate with a problem that you were having with the Vatican, and therefore you had a conversation with him where he really showed that he understood the problems in the Vatican? Those are the kind of things that lead up to this moment. But I think once they get in the Sistine Chapel, either the person's personal spiritual qualities are going to shine forth or they're not. And that's, you know, all you think of how very different the popes that we've had in my lifetime, starting with Paul VI. But all of them at some level conveyed this deep spirituality, from the highly charismatic John Paul II to the very shy and retiring Benedict to the kind of Hamlet-like indecision of Paul. But nonetheless, all of them really seemed to wear the robes naturally and had this sense of inner communion. And they know who they were. You know, the Spanish have a saying, you know, his eggs are in the right place. And this is what a friend of mine who's Argentinian said yesterday about Bergoglio, that his eggs are in the right place. He knows where he is. He knows who he is. He knows his strengths. He knows his limitations and has this inner spirituality that has guided him through his life. And he didn't seem on the loggia yesterday to be overwhelmed at all.
Monsignor Morris, before I let you go,
yes.
Pope Francis changed the process of greeting as well. He added that extra step of praying for his predecessor and also asking for the prayers of the crowd.
Yes.
What did you make of that?
Oh, I thought it was quite beautiful that he would, you know, and kind of reflective, I think, of what we will continue to know about this man and certainly how he has, you know, lived his life as a Jesuit and as an auxiliary bishop, and cardinal, and now as the Pope, you know, really relying upon the prayers of the faithful. And given all that Benedict XVI had spoken about in terms of asking the faithful to pray during this process of sede vacante and then during the conclave, and it was fitting and appropriate that he would then ask. I think what was particularly moving was that he himself bowed and waited for the blessing. So it wasn't just almost kind of a throwaway reality for me. Mm-hmm. You know, pray for me, which oftentimes, you know, you'll hear priests, I say it myself, you know, please pray for me, and you're moving on to the next thing. He actually meant it and actually waited. And then the silence that descended over the piazza, you know, you're looking at, you know, several hundreds of thousands of people spilling down the Via della Conciliazione. Everyone is silently praying for him. And I think that's just a very encouraging sign. Not only for the church internally, but as the church looks outward into the world, that people know that this is a continuation of the work of the Holy Spirit, and obviously, you know, manifested here as we all gather to do what the church consistently does, and that is pray and rely upon the grace of God to assist us.
Monsignor Eugene Morris, thank you so much for joining us today.
And thank you very much.
Monsignor Eugene Morris is the Director of Sacred Liturgy at the Pontifical College Josephinum. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
To maintain a healthy discussion, we suggest a steady diet of Talk of the Nation. We'll nourish your brain with everything from cave diving to dolphin encounters, the rise of China, and the latest shenanigans on Capitol Hill. I'm Neil Conan, your daily recommended dose of news, conversation, and serendipity. Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation is this afternoon from 2 to 4. And on today's Talk of the Nation, where is the line between thought and deed? Join us for that discussion this afternoon at 2. It's 32 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunshine today, warming up to a high near 40. Clouds tonight, a low of 28. Cloudy skies and a little warmer for Friday, a high of 51. Support for 89.7 comes from Home Instead Senior Care, providing non-medical home health care and companionship to seniors in Central Ohio for over 16 years. More at homeinstead.com or 1-800-4-SENIORS. Home Instead Senior Care. To us, it's personal. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. We're talking about the new Pope Francis I with Michael Winters, columnist for the National Catholic Reporter, and also Professor Leo Madden, head of the Department of Theology at Ohio Dominican University. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Michael, any thoughts about that, the greeting, the initial greeting from Pope Francis?
I was moved as everyone, especially by the silence when he asked everyone to pray for him before he gave his blessing to them, and then bowed his head down, and to see 100,000 people who've been cheering and screaming and waving and all this go completely silent. I was completely stunned by that. I thought it was very beautiful, and showed again this kind of humility of a man to say, you can never imagine someone like Pope Pius XII doing that. And probably not even Paul. I mean, it was a stunning moment of humility. The fact that he wasn't doing these demonstrative gestures, but kind of just waving. The kind of perturbed look he gave to the master of ceremonies, who was kind of whispering in his ear something. I mean, everything about it, including what he was wearing. I don't know if you noticed, he came out and he was just wearing the white cassock. Traditionally, popes come out wearing this kind of red ermine-lined mozzetto with a very fancy stole, and there was none of that.
I wondered if that was missing. They did put something around him. They did put some kind of stole around him at the end, Professor Madden. That was significant.
Well, that's the stole for because it was in preparation for his blessing,
right? But the fact that he came out with nothing
with
but
just the white cassock, yeah. I think it indicates his desire to be a simple shepherd, a bishop. He wears white because ever since the 16th century, that's what popes wear. But other than that, the extra clothing, the extra fancy clothing, he's going to disdain. Speaking of that moment of when he requested the prayers of the assembled, and he and the others on the loggia bowed down, that photograph is now on display in many media today, on the front pages of newspapers all over the world. And I think as people, the first impression, as with everything, is very important. And I think the first impression that people have of Pope Francis is that. And for a long period of time, for months and perhaps years less hope of his pontificate, people will remember that as emblematic of his prayerfulness, his desire for silence, his desire to ask others for assistance.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the new Pope, Francis I. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Tom and Marion, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Thank you. Good morning. I wonder if your guest can tell me if the new Pope speaks any other language than his native language, which I assume is Spanish.
Okay. Professor Madden or Michael Winters?
I can take that for a moment. His parents emigrated to Argentina from Italy, and so I'm sure that he's fluent in Italian. Then he probably has a working knowledge of Portuguese. He studied in Germany for his advanced degree in theology, so he certainly can read and speak German. I have every expectation that he speaks and reads a passable English. So certainly that.
Joining us now from Columbus, Omar D'Angelo. He is the owner of D'Angelo's Bakery and a native of Argentina. Omar, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Fine. I wanted to get a little flavor of Argentina in here, and it's the first pope from Argentina, the first pope outside of Europe, really, and wondered, you know, what folks, you've been living here for 12 years now, right?
Yes. And we are here baking all kind of Argentinian cakes, pastries, and we trying to bring the flavor and the culture and also the experience of the Argentinian here in Columbus. And I think that we are doing great. Many people from different countries are trying our pastries and cakes, and they love it.
So what about trying out a pope from Argentina? What do you make of that? Is this a big celebration?
It is. It is. I actually was following the news yesterday in NPR and mm-hmm. the TV, and then when we got home with my mother, the new pope was announced, and we were celebrating. We were happy of being of having a pope, an American pope, and
a pope from the Americas, right?
From the Americas, yeah.
And
yeah, it was a big celebration in Argentina too. People were in the street and trying to celebrate. I think that this pope has a lot of support because he brings a lot of faith, and also he's very humble. He has been living a very community life, and he's very active helper of the poor.
Yeah, we've been kind of skirting around that how what his lifestyle is like. He takes the bus. He doesn't eat out. He cooks for himself.
Yes, I think that he doesn't take advantage of the power. He is what he is, and that's the most important thing. He's there. He's the leader. He's the example, and he. I think that he transmits that to the rest. That's why he has been favorite in the last election and this one too.
Are you talking about this a lot today?
Yes, a lot. Yeah, because all clients, all friends, they're calling, and also the social media is full of comments. And yeah, I think it makes me feel happy and excited and very proud of having an Argentinian there as a sample. And also it inspired me to do more and to do more for the people, because I also do a lot of community service here in Columbus, mm-hmm. and so I know what it is, and I know how to the help that people need, and I'm there when I can.
Professor Madden and Michael, you can pop in here too. But in Argentina, there are. It's mostly Catholic, but a really low percentage of practicing Catholics in Argentina. So there's been talk that this is an effort to re-energize Latin America, re-energize Catholicism in the Americas. Michael Winters?
You know, I think it's hard for us as Americans who grow up in a kind of Protestant and secular culture to imagine how different Latin American cultures are, which were formed in the church. Now, it's my understanding, I've never been to Argentina, that you see some of the secularism there that we see on steroids here in America. But one of the qualities that I've always noticed in Latin American bishops and clergy that I've met, and of the lay faithful, is that they don't have the defensiveness that Catholics have in America. And I think this is, again, American Catholics tend to have imbibed too much of the Calvinism of the culture, for my taste. But I've never found that in the Latin Americans. And I think that has to do with the fact that the culture itself kind of carries along the faith and the beliefs and the holidays and the traditions in ways that are partly reflective of the fact that they've always had a shortage of clergy in Latin America. So the devotional life of the people has never been dependent on the presence of a priest, because there often was not a priest. But it goes deeper. It goes, to the way that their families and extended families still gather in ways that we simply don't in the U.S. anymore.
Omar D'Angelo, the reputation of the Pope in Argentina is not untainted. He was the head of the Jesuit order there during Argentina's 1976 to 1983 dictatorship, right? And when there were thousands of kidnappings and killings of reputed subversives and so forth. Do you have any sense about that, having moved here 12 years ago yourself?
Well, yeah, that happened a long time ago, and I'm not familiar with that. But I know that he has been fighting with everything and trying to bring peace. And I think he has been doing a great job. And, I think that he would do a great job now as a Pope.
Okay. Omar D'Angelo, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you so much.
Omar D'Angelo, he's the owner of D'Angelo's Bakery and a native of Argentina. If you have a question or comment for our guests, Michael Winters is a columnist for the National Catholic Reporter, and Leo Madden is the head of the Department of Theology at Ohio Dominican University. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Michael Winters, what about that? Are there any other are there some shadows in the background of this pope?
I've heard both sides of the story about how what he did or did not do during the Dirty War. Of course, he wasn't really in a leadership position in the 1970s.
Right.
The way he became later in life. And obviously, that was an enormously complicated time.
Yeah,
we will certainly find that out. I mean, you know, we now live in a day when, you know, newspapers are hunt down stories like that. So I really don't know. I do know, yesterday there were some grumblings from certain liberation theologians who were worried that he had always been opposed to liberation theology. You know, my sense is that liberation theology's heyday has come and gone. It still has more of a life on American college campuses than it has in Latin America. Certainly, it's not prevalent among the Latin American bishops to any degree. Those kind of grumblings. I mean, somebody I heard, that a Jesuit priest at Georgetown said, oh, he's an ideologue. And I'm thinking, you know, I know some Jesuit priests at Georgetown who are ideologues. So, you know, we will see. The only other thing I would always caution everyone is, you know, when Cardinal Ratzinger was elected as Pope Benedict, everyone was like, oh, my God, this is awful. Dip Ponser Cardinal. And he turned out to be a very gentle pastor. And I think, you know, a prior person's career as a cardinal and their career as Pope, there's not always complete continuity there because the job is very different, certainly in Ratzinger's case, because before that he had a desk job. We never saw a picture of Joseph Ratzinger with children until he became Pope.
Hmm.
This guy obviously has been a pastor. I think that was the principal reason he was elected, is that he's, you know, has this pastoral sensibility, which you even saw, you know, on the loggia last night when what did he do? He led them not in some 14th century Latin prayer. He led everyone in the Our Father and the Hail Mary, prayers that the children in the crowd would know.
Hmm.
And I thought that just, you know, this is a guy who's been in front of the people of God up close and personal for most of his life. And I suspect that's what the cardinals saw in him that they wanted.
Professor Madden?
One of the words that has been used to describe Pope Francis is simplicity. And we see this already, and we've talked about it, his dress, you know, only in the white cassock. But it's also simplicity in getting back to the fundamentals of the faith. As he did this even when he was as the head of the Jesuit order in Argentina, then as the Archbishop of Buenos Aires, and I suspect it will continue as the Pope. He will hew the straight line of being true to the essentials of the faith and the model of Jesus Christ. So he will say no. He has said no to Jesuit priests who get involved in direct action and political action in the political controversies and military controversies in Argentina. At the same time, he will say no to other aspects of where the Catholic faith touches the social and economic life of the country and the world, where there are errors to be found. He will say no to those things. He will maintain the conviction to the simple truths of the faith. And I think we saw that already from the loggia.
Steve in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you. Why do we anglicize the Pope's name? Like, why do we change it from Francesco to Francis?
Is that just us, or are they doing that everywhere? Michael?
Well, I think it's done everywhere, and I think that actually shows some of the insight. I mean, you know, the faith isn't just out there in the ether. It's always enculturated, you know, and the days are gone when we all go to Mass in Latin. We now go to Mass in English or Spanish or Portuguese, depending on where you are. But I think the papal name was always vernacularized. I mean, I've never heard Americans refer to Giovanni the 23rd. It was John the 23rd for Americans. So I think that just goes with the turf. And if it was to only be in one language, it would be Latin. And alas, that's a language no one speaks really.
Except 11th graders who are studying it in high school or something.
Amen.
Like that.
Bless them if they are. It's the best thing I ever did.
Steve, thanks for the call. Anything to add to that, Leo Madden?
Nothing really. I just want to go back to something that we talked about earlier, mm-hmm. namely what we can read in the tea leaves of the decision of the College of Cardinals here. You know, mm-hmm. because perhaps there will emerge some hints and, you know, discussions over cappuccino in the bars of Rome. Who knows? But I think it's significant that he was elected on the fifth ballot. This is really quite rapid. According to a statement made by Cardinal Worrell of Washington, Cardinal Worrell mentioned that on Wednesday morning, before the Cardinals went over to the Sistine Chapel, they all gathered for their morning concelebrated Mass. And Cardinal Worrell was standing beside Cardinal Bergoglio, now Pope Francis. And Cardinal Worrell said that Bergoglio had no inclination, no worries, no sensibility that there was this groundswell of interest in him. I think Bergoglio thought that there was no way he was going to be Pope. So something happened yesterday inside that chapel where there was an enormous and powerful consensus. He has to get two-thirds in order to be elected. An enormous and powerful consensus of the cardinals that this is the person and this is the kind of person that we want to lead the church right now. Michael, do you have any other further thoughts?
Michael
about
Winters?
That?
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, and I think I hope we'll find out exactly, you know, how the coalition was built up. You know, my sources say that you know, on the very first ballot, Wednesday night, Tuesday night, he came out ahead, which I think was everyone's kind of surprise. And part of that was may have been there were people who had been voting for him in 2005 that were still in the college. Maybe some new faces who found something attractive in him, and that he was even ahead of Cardinal Scola, who I think was the Italian cardinal largely seen as a front runner, but more importantly, he was significantly ahead of Cardinal Ouellette from Canada, who had become the kind of non-Italian candidate, you know. And I don't want to emphasize the secular political aspect to this. Of course, there's a spiritual side, and this guy, as we all saw last night, has this deep spirituality that's quite accessible. But we can't overlook the fact that insofar as a certain number of cardinals said we're never giving it back to the Italians, if Bergoglio was then, you know, 10 or 15 votes ahead of Cardinal Ouellette, he becomes that candidate in the same way as in the Republican primaries last year. You know, it was always Romney and the un-Romney, and, mm-hmm. and the person who was the un-Romney changed a couple times. And so I think people were a little surprised that Bergoglio came out as the you know, non-Italian candidate, and a lot of votes obviously coalesced around him quite quickly.
Well, we're going to continue our conversation. I'm talking with Michael Winters, columnist for the National Catholic Reporter. Well, actually, we have to say goodbye to you, Michael, don't
I
we?
Do. Great.
Thank
Great
you for joining
you,
us.
Great to be with you, Professor Madden.
All the best. Thanks, Michael.
Michael Winters, once again, columnist for the National Catholic Reporter, staying with us. Professor Leo Madden, head of the Department of Theology at Ohio Dominican University, and coming up, Louise Akers, former coordinator of the Sisters of Charity of Cincinnati Office of Peace, Justice, and Integrity of Creation. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Barack Obama was a controversial pathbreaker in putting big private money in campaign politics. Now he's doing it in the White House. We investigate. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point is this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station. Thanks for joining us today for All Sides with Ann Fisher. Be sure to listen tomorrow for a look at how religion is changing in Cuba. And then join Classical 101 host Christopher Purdy for the best in arts and culture in Central Ohio. It's All Sides and All Sides Weekend tomorrow from 10 until noon. And it's 32 degrees, sunshine today with a high near 40. Support comes from Homeport Nobo on Long Condominiums, offering homeownership opportunities in the King Lincoln District, featuring a diverse community with a mix of historic and newly built homes and condos. Details at homeportohio.org/NOBO on Long. And support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with the 2013 Wellness Series. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's Wellness Series are at go.osu.edu/series. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
That's a performance of Puccini's Messa di Gloria by the Capriccio Vocal Ensemble in Columbus. Their next concert is coming up in April, and you can go to a link on our website at wosu.org/allsides for more on that. We just thought a little music was in keeping with the spirit of the day. This hour, we've been talking about the election of Pope Francis I. Still with us, Professor Leo Madden. He heads the Department of Theology at Ohio Dominican University. And joining us now by phone is Louise Akers. She is the former coordinator of the Sisters of Charity of Cincinnati Office of Peace, Justice, and Integrity of Creation. She remains affiliated with the order, now writes and does public speaking. Louise, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Louise, you've spoken for more of a role for women in the church, and especially for women, ordination of women. What is your reaction, I guess, in terms of that, to the election of Pope Francis I?
First, I'd just like to comment on some of the... I've been listening to the discussion. And I think expanding the vision, putting women within the context of this new pope who chose the name Francis, as was mentioned before, Francis of Assisi, who was a reformer of the church, a lover of those persons living in poverty, a lover of creation. I think today that translates into what Catholic social teaching refers to as preferential option for the poor and care of creation. So those two priorities certainly are priorities of many of the faithful, of the people of God, and certainly of my own community, mm-hmm. as are women. Now, with regard to the theology of the new Pope Francis, I think... has also been mentioned, he's a traditionalist. He's very conservative on doctrine, especially doctrine that refers to social issues, whether that be mandatory celibacy, homosexuality, artificial contraception, and in the case that you asked me about, women, the expanded role of women in the church. And I think women in the church did have a presence in Rome outside of the conclave, but also got some substantial media coverage. And the whole, I guess at the heart of the movement of women within the church is that we ask to be recognized as equals to the men in the church. And that includes an expanded role, especially with regard to decision-making and policies, but also recognition of our dignity and value of and as human beings, and to recognize that indeed we can be called to ordination or to priesthood. I personally do not wish to ever be a priest, but I honor those who say they feel called, just as men feel called. So that's kind of, I know, the litmus test, but that's not the whole of the women's movement in the church. Mm-hmm. It's much beyond that. but inclusive of that.
And this has been a rough year for women who are seeking more of a role in the church. There was the study group that was put together last spring, I believe, right?
There are lots of study groups.
Well, to study the role of women in the church and what it should be.
Well, there are a number of organizations, such as the Women's Ordination Conference, such as Future Church. Our own office within my congregation certainly has studied ordination, the history of it, and the possible future of it, and what our role is as women in the church, or what's sometimes referred to as ecclesial women.
But the Vatican, Leo Madden, any interest?
Well, this was just in regard to the issue of governance of the church. This is an area where, let me just speak broadly, and then I can go with the diocesan level. But speaking broadly in the governance of the church, one thing that Benedict did is he did appoint women to certain curial positions. And I think much more can be done to appoint women to various pontifical councils. I don't think there's any impediment there, you know, for women to be appointed to various pontifical councils like the Pontifical Theological Commission or the Pontifical Biblical Commission. None of those are intimately tied to the governance of the church. One area where, if I may question a decision by Pope Benedict, was where he said that because the role of the Apostolic Nuncio or the papal ambassador is so closely tied to the governance of the church, those positions are restricted to men. That was a decision. I don't know the canonical status of that decision, whether it can be revised by a future pope or not. I presume so. And this is an area where I think I don't see an impediment there. So that's looking broadly. Looking specifically at the diocesan level or the national level, in every diocese in the United States, I presume, there are women in charge of many organizations and in charge of many aspects of parish life. And the sister can speak to that.
And thank you. That is absolutely true. I think another aspect of the whole issue of the possible further inclusion of women in the church and ultimately ordination is that today in the church, people are being silenced, myself among them, or excommunicated, like Father Roy Bourgeois, for even discussing the issue. And certainly we understand that it's a current doctrine of the church, but to encourage dialogue and discussion and reflection and to recognize primacy of conscience, you know, there are so many dimensions to any issue that's being discussed in the church or any crisis in the church. You know, the fact that, you know, the whole pedophile crisis, you know, what happens in that with regard to pedophiles, but also on the part of many bishops to the cover-up, you know, and certainly abuse of children is against any teaching about the value and dignity of people. There's a mixed message here.
From Mark on Facebook had a question. He said, how about the Pope starting with admission of truth on how the Vatican and its politics protected the needs of its own by protecting pedophile priests instead of protecting the safety and welfare of thousands of children of the church who were abused by countless priests in office? The Vatican ignored reports from other bishops on continuing abuses as recent as 2009 from Dublin, Ireland. As one example, the layers of secrecy to protect offenders instead of children. What will the new Pope Francis do to dismantle what has not been working in the Vatican? Now, I don't necessarily see former Pope Benedict or his emeritus Pope Benedict, I guess, as ignoring those reports. He addressed them, didn't he, Professor Mann?
As Pope, yep. Yes.
Okay.
As Pope, he did.
Yes. So what about going forward on those issues that do, we haven't talked about them yet this hour even, but that do cloud a lot of people's view of the Catholic Church within and without?
This is looking at it, you know, a very small window. This is a public relations nightmare, and in addition to which is a personal nightmare of every individual who was sexually abused. It's a nightmare that recurs every day, every hour, I presume. One thing that the Catholic Church in the United States has done is institute the Protecting God's Children program, which is an extraordinary achievement, and which the Catholics in the United States should be proud of.
Yes.
But at the same time, reports of abuse from years past, sometimes going back decades, continue to pop up. Most of the reports of abuse, as I read it, are abuse that took place decades ago. They're not abuses that have taken place in recent years. Even the case of the Cardinal O'Brien in Scotland deals with inappropriate behavior of decades ago.
I think, too, that part, again, another aspect of the pedophile crisis was and is the cover-up of some of the bishops of the crisis. And it seems to me that the cardinals who elected Pope Francis knew of his reputation, knew of his lifestyle, not only of the preferential option for the poor, but also that he, in some ways, was counterpoint to a lot of what's happening in the church today. So reform, it seems to me, in choosing Pope Francis, is reform of not only the pedophile crisis, but the crisis within the Vatican Bank, the crisis within the Curia, so that if he is indeed a reformer in those areas of the church, that's a significant moment in our church. And a wonderful moment.
He's an outsider. And in many ways, he's an outsider. I mean, he didn't spend a lot of time at the Vatican and really wanted to stay away from it.
Yes, indeed.
Right.
He never had an appointment to any council or congregation.
Although he was offered.
He was offered, and he always refused. Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Louise Akers, what was your reaction when you heard yesterday? You and I, when we were talking yesterday, we were both had the TV out in the background.
Right.
We were both waiting. What do you think?
You mean when he was announced?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I, from the get-go and today still, hang on to the fact that he chose as his name that he would be known as Pope Francis because of the tremendous legacy of Francis of Assisi, who was, as was said in the earlier part of your show, a reformer within the church, you know, that he heard speak to him and say, you know, rebuild my church. And to me, that is so significant. And also because of the Pope's, what we know at this point of his lifestyle, that in itself speaks of reform.
Well, you
and
know,
as you were saying earlier, how he came out on the balcony in his simple white.
Professor Madden and I were talking during the break that, you know, he took the bus with the cardinals yesterday to the banquet or wherever they were going after the presentation in St. Peter Square. But is he going to take the bus anymore?
I think it's going to be a real challenge to him personally to continue to live the way he believes he needs to live in light of a lot of the pomp and circumstance and tradition within the Vatican. I think that's going to be a major challenge for him.
And in addition, I think his choice of a name, there are some other signals that I anticipate coming from Pope Francis. I anticipate, for example, encouragement to every bishop that there should be a greater priority at a bureaucratic level, at a practical level, a greater priority to this sort of outreach to the poor, to the sick,
yeah,
to the sick, to the homeless. And that is to say, in the organizational structure of every parish, of every diocese, and maybe even every parish, there should be an upper-level office of social concern, not a sub-sub office of social concern that's buried under some other part of the bureaucratic structure. That this should be at every meeting of a bishop and the major questions of how to use resources.
What are we doing for the poor?
This should be on the table.
His assignment was said in an article yesterday or this morning to be a great one. It is administrative, moral, and expected to take the church to a new place in the future. And one theologian said that what the church needs now is Jesus Christ with an MBA. which is kind of a startling notion, but and funny, you know, witty, I suppose. But Louise Akers, agree, disagree, or some variation on that theme?
Well, I think that's my first response to that is certainly it's a rather elitist description.
Mm-hmm.
When you put, you know, Jesus, and certainly was a wise person. He didn't need an MBA. But in the world today, I understand what the statement implies. And obviously, organizational ability was a priority, at least prior to the conclave, that the bishops were talking about. So, you know, I would say whatever it takes, and it sounds like Francis has the ability.
There's another initiative that I expect this pope to take, and that has to do with the appointment of bishops. Who are the individuals? What are the qualities that he is going to encourage subtly, right?
It's kind of like the Supreme Court for the president.
Right. He encourages certain qualities. Now, we're all familiar, I think, with individuals who sort of have a desire to move up the ranks, move up the church ladder. Something tells me that he's going to change the composition of those steps on the going up the church ladder. And another suggestion I think he'll make is is regard to priestly formation in seminaries. What are the qualities that we are going to encourage in priestly formation? And what we've talked about already regarding outreach to the poor, the sick, the abandoned in our society, this will be a very high priority for priestly formation.
I would hope so. I would hope that would be a priority, and I would also hope that the attitudes and the knowledge of the history of women in the church would be a priority, because I don't think it is or has been. And with new scholarship in the last 20, 25 years coming from the scholarship of women who prior to this had been prohibited from higher academic learning in the church and in other institutions, I think a lot of new history has been revealed that could help the church in a more progressive posture towards women and other marginalized people, which brings up a whole other issue of homosexuals within the church.
Louise Akers, we're going to have to end it at that. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Louise Akers is the former coordinator of the Sisters of Charity of Cincinnati Office of Peace, Justice, and Integrity of Creation. Also, Professor Leo Madden, thank you for joining us again today.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you, Anne.
Professor Madden is the head of the Department of Theology at Ohio Dominican University. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producers Corinne Gleckler and Rachel Quimby, production assistants Karim Shaban and Leticia Wiggins. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher. Thanks for listening today. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.